And we're going to be having like a crowdfunding Kickstarter campaign to cover some parts where we have more languages, more platforms, right, more themes to expand on the offering. But the base application itself is now built and ready. And one important aspect about accessibility that we haven't mentioned before is that the platform is going to be available in multiple languages, including simplified Chinese as well as traditional Chinese. Right. So it's going to be, you know, hopefully bringing game development to a large audience worldwide.
Right. Please allow me to explain this in Chinese real quick to our Chinese audiences. 大家好，大家如果需要用它的平台去打造一个游戏，但是不需要编码的话，就可以到它的这个平台上 creative.net, right? 而且呢，它还有简体中文和繁体中文两种选择，还有其他的语言. All right. So yeah, I know that this is a radio show, so we couldn't show our radio audiences how it looks like. But I know that you do have a YouTube video where people can watch it and see how the result looks like. And we will show that to our live streaming audiences after the show. But now, could you share with us how can we find this video if anybody who tuning in about radio?
Yeah, so if you go to YouTube, there's a type creative and the channel's creative app. So if you go to the creative channel, you'll find it's a single video right now that is like a 4-minute introduction about the application and what it looks like in action. Yeah.
Great. Awesome. So I wanted to turn back to your story, your belief when you created this, right? To understand like why you have to make this, because a lot of people, they play games or they can write coding, they can do a lot of things around or in this industry, but never really many people I met to decide it to help people do this without coding. So I wonder what was there a specific moment when you knew, like, I have to do this?
So a few years back, during 2020, I was tasked, I was working in Saudi Arabia back then, and I was tasked with teaching and leading a class of grade 6 and 7 students.
Yeah.
So 6, 7, but not intentionally,
right,
toward making a PlayStation 5 game during the summer of that year.
Right.
So at the time, obviously, COVID was the kind of the main theme of the world at the time. And even though I was like physically, you know, a few blocks away from the school itself, I never got to meet the students. So everything was remote, but we managed to go through it. So we've built a 3D action game in a matter of 45 days. It was using traditional tools, but I saw the creativity that those students were able to bring to the process. So they would work on the level design and the ideas and the story of the game itself. And then I would be working on the technical aspects of the back end development and the engine development.
Right.
So that was using popular game engines at the time. And we managed to release that on PlayStation. And it got selected by PlayStation as part of their PlayStation Plus program, which is, you know, they only select, you know, back then 3 or 4 games worldwide to give as a kind of an offering for the subscribers. So that was a huge vote of confidence by Sony PlayStation into the product. And so because of that experience and the amount of passion that, you know, all of a sudden we have elementary school students who have a PlayStation game on their portfolio. So imagine how that would help in their future, you know,
right,
and in their career in general.
Right.
So I wanted to kind of take that experience and make it scalable so that it's not dependent on my time or my availability to a certain set of students, but that everybody around the world can achieve something similar or even better.
Right.
So that was kind of a major spark beyond the platform.
I see. Well, I want to ask something about the culture, because our show is also East Meets West cross-cultural related show. You mentioned several times that you used to leave and got this idea and experience in Saudi Arabia, right?
Yep.
And then now you are in Vancouver, Canada. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, growing up, there is this kind of a lot of, you know, preconceived notions and misconceptions about the Middle East in general. Like, we're conditioned to, you know, watch movies and TV shows and play video games that take place in that part of the world that only show you a specific narrative in a specific kind of way.
Right.
So, take, for example, you know, most of the popular war movies. You're always in a Middle Eastern war-torn zone. Something bad is about to happen, or something bad just happened, and there are, you know, angry Middle Eastern-looking people screaming at you. So
right.
That's the kind of the current kind of, you know, populist or, you know, the current cultural representation that we had up until recently. So I wanted to kind of, you know, if I were to build something that is taking place in modern day Middle East, like in modern day Dubai or Riyadh or any of these locations, how would it look like? How would we, you know, convey the cultural aspect, the history, the rich history that we have, but also infuse it with modern day, you know, the lifestyle and the way that things really are in there. And without even, you know, putting a positive spin on things, sometimes just showing things the way they are, it's kind of like the biggest, you know, contribution that you can have toward
right.
that. So in an effort to do that, you know, I've been building games that were inspired by Middle Eastern culture for the most of my career, and trying to kind of, you know, show different aspects, be it, you know, in modern day or in historical contexts. So that's a major...
Right. Could you compare the lifestyle and the culture between South Arabia and Vancouver, Canada, or North America?
So I'll tell you that, you know, because I grew up watching TV shows and movies and playing video games, I didn't have, you know, a big cultural shock when I came here. So I'll tell you one specific video game example. So in video games, there used to be this company called Sierra. Sierra would make adventure games, point-and-click adventure games,
right.
that were taking place in different time periods, different themes. One of them was a game called Gabriel Knight. Gabriel Knight is a paranormal detective who lives in New Orleans. So in New Orleans, there's this rich kind of, you know, French influence on the city. There's that all of that, you know, the culture, the cultural aspects regarding, you know, voodoo, regarding all of the you know, different mystery, mysterious kind of aspects that happened over the course of the history of that location. And so they would use that as an angle and then show you the city and show you all the different landmarks and all the like the major historical characters and put it in a kind of a thriller context. And so when I meet somebody from the U.S. who happens to be from New Orleans and then talk about all these things, they're super surprised that, you know, somebody from Saudi Arabia would know these very particular locations
right.
and very specific locations. And that, you know, carries across different experiences, you know, in different genres, different games that I've been. So by the time I came here back, you know, a few years back, like 5 years at this point, I already was accustomed to the kind of the American culture, the Canadian culture, and, you know, what to expect in terms of, you know, food, how to talk to people, how to kind of, you know, interact with them through different avenues. So that was like a great experience in that regard compared to, you know, somebody who just is used to a very particular culture, not really used to something from the outside that
right.
make a difference.
That's a very unique perspective. And it does inspire me to think about some memories and experiences of how I got to know the world outside of China when I was still in China. Is that like through playing games, through watching movies, you've already exposed under those kind of culture, you've already prepared yourself emotionally, mentally, and you got this excitement that you want to meet those people, make friends, learning their language through gaming, through movies, right?
Sure.
I know that earlier you talked with our producer music department, Connor, and he was a guest in our show. And we started having this conversation with Black Myth Wukong. And I know he grew up in the States and Canada. So he is a representative of a gamer and an enthusiastic gamer in North America. And you are the you are the person from the other side, like not just geographically, but also in terms of gaming. You create a game, you build a game, now you build a platform. Could you share a little bit about how was the conversation and what did you guys talk about?
Sure. So he started the conversation with saying, you know, he is a musician himself.
Right.
So he's into chiptune music, which is, you know, associated with indie games. Like usually we'd have this retro style kind of, you know, music that is made by the computer hardware itself. So it would sound retro.
Right.
And because of that, you know, like that was a great starting point to discuss one topic that is near and dear to my heart, which is interactive music. So that was, you know, one of the key things that we discussed. So, you know, like imagine in a video game scenario. So let's say you're playing a survival game set in the desert. You want the music to start, you know, kind of ambient in the beginning. You're isolated, you're alone, and then you would find like an oasis, for example, or you would find a horse. As you get close to the horse, the music would ramp up, adding more layers, more tracks. When you ride the horse itself, it ramps up in intensity. When you start galloping, then that's when the intensity would peak. And then what happens at that point if you got ambushed by bandits?
Right.
So all of these changes that happen in real time, the music would respond to, and therefore you're feeling like you are directing the experience, even though you're just playing a video game.
Right.
But because the interactive music was developed that way, it gives that extra layer of immersion that you don't just get with a normal movie.
Right.
So and then once you're done with that battle, the music will kind of wind down and then goes back to the ambient sound. So that's something that requires, in order to develop it, usually would require, you know, both a programmer to actually program the behavior, but also a musician to create the multiple tracks and multiple kind of instruments that would then be layered on top of each other.
Right.
So something like that, you know, I by myself, like I listen to music, but I wouldn't be like, I'm not into the actual act of composing them or making them. So, but because I had to build a system like that for a game I was working on,
right,
I got to work with musicians. One of them, Matt Baldler, actually ended up, I worked with him 10 years ago, but he ended up doing work for the Dune movie that came in 2021, as well as the last James Bond No Time to Die movie.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, your friend who is is working with Hans Zimmer and with all of these, you know, great composers working on these major franchises. That's exactly the kind of experiences that developing video games brings to you, like as a person, and to the culture itself. So that's.
How the topic got started. I mean, that's really like a great point, because they're talking about movies or musics or games, and then basically your hobbies, right? That is a great topic to get started when we wanted to connect or networking with people who are from different cultures. We often feel like daunted because like, oh my God, I don't know anything. So I am also very introverted, so I don't know how to get started. But yeah, like talking about what you like and talk about what they like, you will definitely find some fundamental principles that's just under everything that's the same, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, like, can I ask when the real users first created something meaningful with Creative? What did that moment feel like to you?
So, very good question. So, I got the application at an early adopter state back in December. So I've been attending these kind of the Vancouver AI meetup, which is a monthly meetup that's been going on for a couple of years at the HR McMillan Space Center here.
Right.
So I got to present Creative on stage for a couple of minutes. And then by the end of the presentation, I told the audience, you know, if you're interested, you know, come talk to me and let's see how we can, you know, collaborate on this. One of the people who reached out was the director of Ethos Lab. Mm. Ethos Lab is a nonprofit community center here in Vancouver that teaches students how to deal with AI in game making and music and in creative production in general.
Right.
So we've ran a pilot where during the month of December, 14 students of that community center got access to Creative, and was a really eye-opening experience, because now, for the first time, we have not only actual users for the platform, but they are the most difficult and the most demanding kind of, like they're not going to shy away from giving you, you know, critical feedback, right?
Right.
And at the same time, they're used to Minecraft and Fortnite and all of these applications and so these games. And so they know what to expect, right? And they expect that of you. So you have to kind of rise to the occasion. And so it was a great experience. By the end of the month, now they're interested in using the application at home, not just at the school, not just at the center. And hopefully now we're going to, you know, roll that out to a larger, cohort that they have throughout the year as well.
Wait, so I'm guessing that students or even other people can give a free trial to use your platform, right?
So the application is going to have multiple tiers. So there's going to be a free tier available to everybody. So you get to create two projects with two themes and two biomes. So this is a way for you to, you know, just get your hands on the tool and try it and see what you can make with it. But then there's a pro version that will give you all of the library of theme packs and all of the biomes and will allow you to make commercial products.
Right.
So this way, like when you're ready, you're able to kind of, you know, expand your creativity with that.
Yeah, that's a great design for people to try it out. And then when they have the taste of what kind of game they wanted to build, and then they can just get into more details with the pro version,
sure.
Right?
And, you know, one thing about Creative is that it also encourages collaboration. So,
right.
For example, let's say that we're making a game here. I can assign you a level 2, and then Connor will be working on level 3, and I'm working on level 1. So we can collaborate on the same. So imagine in a classroom environment, the instructor can, you know, lead the process or ask one of the students to be the team leader, and then that person would be asked to assign different tasks, and we can collaborate together and finish a project even faster than it already is.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, so in this show, we talk a lot about how to build things from zero to one.
Yeah.
And you, as a founder of Creative and also entrepreneur, I really wanted you to share about like the real world experience in partnerships, storytelling, and navigating uncertainty as a founder, offering the practical insights for the creators and other entrepreneurs or even people who just wanted to build something or change the new industry in the AI era, right? So first question is very specific. Can you think about the hardest no you received while building Creative?
The hardest no was when I first started, I was looking for pre-seed investment to the project. So usually pre-seed is you have an idea, you have a prototype, and you're trying to convince investors to, you know, give you just enough so that you can finish building the product and get it to the market as soon as possible. So I kept hearing, because I was pitching it to investors who invest into the traditional tech industry, I kept hearing that this is too good to be true. It's too
impossible.
Big, too ambitious, almost impossible. And that's why I said, you know, they're probably used to kind of applications that are of a different kind of, not particularly gaming, so maybe more into like the general tech idea, SaaS applications, etc. So I started showing it to video game professionals who have 30, 40 plus years of experience. Some of them, I played their games when I was 5. So they do have a lot of experience. And then I kept hearing the same answer, that this is what they thought video game development would be like when they entered, but it's really not, because there's a lot of obstacles, a lot of tedious manual work that has to be done, and that's why it's expensive today. And so I told myself, you know, if everybody thinks this is such a tough problem to solve, it's worth solving.
Right.
Because remember what you mentioned about 0 to 1. There is an entrepreneurship, if you're opening a traditional kind of business, that's a path that has been charted before. People have been down it. We know what it's like to open a restaurant, more or less. Like the challenges will be different, the scale will be different, but the overall experience has been done before. But when you're working in venture capital or, you know, on something that is venture backable in the future, you're expected to come up with something that is going to be most likely never been done before, or never been done before at this scale or in this way or for this particular audience. So you're going through uncharted territory filled with uncertainty. That uncertainty comes from the technology itself, from business constraints, from distribution, how to scale it properly, how to have the proper infrastructure for it. So luckily, because I've worked at AWS, I've been exposed to how to serve millions of transactions per second for massive scale of customers, you know, like the Roblox of the world, Disney Plus, Citigroup, etc. So that that kind of removed that layer of fear that a traditional entrepreneur would usually have, and then tried to apply that to the niche, which is game development and creation in general. So because of all of that, you have to take a lot of chances. You have to, nine times out of ten, you're probably going to be wrong, right? But for that one time where it works, it's going to be magic. That's the hope for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I totally can relate it to it. To be honest, if you ask me what was the hardest no that I received, I cannot tell. I don't remember because it's all no's until you got something succeed. It's like, this is something that I wanted to share 2 points. First is from my own perspective and experience is that, like you said, it's like from zero to one, it just requires a lot of exploration. You gotta know what's the standard, but at the same time, you have to do something not just you never done before. Probably no other people have done that successfully before. So yeah, of course, you have been doing something that's out of your knowledge span, that's out of everybody else's imagination. So of course you make mistakes, but I think the only successful ones or entrepreneurs, they do not stop by the failures or no's, but they iterate from there. So you always change your trajectory, right? And another thing that I heard is very interesting from some really big investors is that this is something I really agree is that most of the people, especially for managers, not necessarily entrepreneurs or other people, they just like if you ask them to do something, most likely 99.9% of people will say no. Because if they say yes, that means a lot more work, a lot more responsibilities.
Exactly. What if it fails, right? So
yeah, so saying no is an easy answer. I don't want to take the responsibility and I don't need to take extra work that leads to nothing. So this makes me feel a lot better because, now I know that people say no, not necessary just to reject or deny your ideas. And probably just because they don't want to do things and carry responsibilities.
Exactly. The risk is but then again, risk is why we have, the Bay Area being successful in terms of entrepreneurship versus other parts of the world not being quite as successful. There has to be that that sense of risk taking, the acceptance of failure. Because if you make it so that, taking risks is punished, then you're going to be ending up with all of these kind of boring ideas.
Yeah.
With tech in general, you're expected to come up with the next big thing, hopefully at some point. And that's why, it's an interesting space to be in.
Yeah. Some people are just good at exploring things. Some people are good at managing it and expand it. So find your own group and then you will feel better. And I do wanted to ask some question related to our show called Call Me Negotiator, because doing entrepreneurship, running business, or create something that's from zero to one, or anything, even not from zero to one, there's a lot of negotiation and communication happen between two sides or a few different parties. Can you share something that you can think of or you learned about negotiation in this entrepreneurial way?
So the very first project that I worked on that actually got released on PlayStation, that was back in 2011. So at that time, in order to develop something for PlayStation, you need something called a dev kit. A dev kit is like a normal PlayStation, but it has more memory, more capabilities, and it looks looks different than the actual one that you find at stores.
Mm.
That is usually a very expensive device to get, and moving it across countries is very restrictive. So customs will always raise eyebrows about it and all that.
Mm.
So, but you do need it in order to develop games for PlayStation. So, and the same thing for Xbox as well. So at the time, before actually releasing the game, I had to travel to San Francisco to GDC, the Game Developer Conference, to London, and to basically convince and talk to the management at both Sony and Microsoft in order to convince them to give us a chance to get that dev kit. It took us 3 years to get a single dev kit into the country.
Oh.
That is how time-consuming the processes versus here in North America or in Europe, it would take a couple of months.
Okay.
So that difference between a couple of months and a couple of years is what the whole world is up against versus like the traditional development hubs that these companies are usually used to work with. So convincing them to actually give us that chance meant building prototypes, showing that we have not only the passion, because passion by itself is not going to make you help you make a game, but you also have the ability to execute on the concept. So with a real kind of, you know, 10-minute demo, there's the vertical slice. A vertical slice is a, you know, a term that we use in the industry. So think of it, you know, think of a pizza. So a slice of a pizza is most probably going to give you an idea how the rest of the slices are going to be like.
Right.
So it's going to be more of the same, more likely. So it has all of the components, all the ingredients on that one slice. So usually in games, you would build something like that so that it's a small segment of your game. Could be one level, probably in the middle of the game where you have all of the systems and your character can do all of the features.
Right.
And then that is what you show to investors and to publishers to get convince them to give you funding. So we had to build a vertical slice like that, get it working on the like on PC first, and then on the those diff kits, and yeah, show it to those people, convince them that there is a real serious attempt at making a game. That game ended up being localized in 20 languages, including Chinese and Japanese. For me, that was big because I grew up watching Japanese dubbed anime dubbed to Arabic. So that was literally my childhood. That was so for the game to be dubbed to or to be translated to both Chinese and Japanese, that meant, you know, I'm contributing something. I'm giving something in the other direction, right?
No,
it's not just a one-way communication anymore.
Right.
So that, you know, was an important milestone for me personally that I feel a lot of people should, you know, try to kind of, you know, tell stories and share their experiences with the world with. So hopefully that's what will happen.
Yeah, that's very helpful. What I heard is that negotiation is not just like, oh, how articulate you could be or how good you talk to them, but you wanted to take actions. You show them with real work as the first piece of pizza, right? So as our show towards to the end, the last question I want you to share with our audience is that if you could leave young creators in China and around the world with one final thought, what would you want them to remember about creation?
That no successful creation was designed like that. Probably that creation went through a lot of failures before that one moment or that one version of it sparked. So don't be afraid to make mistakes.
Right.
The one thing that is important to do is to surround yourself by people and by tools, by software that would allow the creation and the failure that comes with it to be non-fatal. So you don't want to basically work on a project for a couple of years, then show it to people, and then find that they don't want it, and you discover that you haven't been kind of, you know, doing it, doing what people want. So basically, create things, small prototypes, iterate, make mistakes. You will find haters everywhere. That's just the way of life, especially with the internet. So kind of get into the mindset that, you know, there will be, out of 10, there will be probably 5 people that hate your game, another 5 that will like it. It's just that where are those distributed? Where are, like, are you talking to the right location, to the right target audience that will appreciate what you're trying to do? Another example, you know, example of that, you know, one of the projects that I worked on, because it was so early on in the like in the age of the Middle Eastern gaming industry, the expectations some people had is that this is a AAA game, you know, something that would be able to compete on the Call of Duty and the Uncharted level. While what we had internally is, hey, we managed to create something and release it, so we're happy and proud that we've managed to do it.
Yeah.
Others were expecting, you know, super extremely high level of quality. So between the two, there was a kind of, you know, a bit of miscommunication that that resulted in, you know, some people not liking the end product. But that's, you know, something that you learn with time, and hopefully people can get
just solve the problem. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And that's the end of today's show. Thank you for tuning in for CJSF 90.1 FM. And if you want to try more, just go to creative.net. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you next week.
新的街头，影子渐渐拉长，风吹过斑驳的墙壁，带来远方的回响。夜色温柔入睡，悄悄浸湿了我的眼眸，那些遗落的诺言在雨